This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. The United Nations Refugee Agency is appealing to Sudan's neighbors to keep their borders open to people fleeing the fighting that erupted on April 15th. Since fighting between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces erupted, thousands of Sudanese have been forced to leave their homes in fear of their lives. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he's working very closely with the United Nations on the crisis in Sudan.
We believe that the best way to have an enduring capability to help people leave Sudan, if that's what they so choose, is overland. And we are working to establish a process that would enable people to move overland to a place where they can more easily exit the country, in all likelihood Port Sudan. So that's under very active development.
Despite an extension of the latest ceasefire between the warring parties, fighting was reported in Khartoum and the western Darfur region on Thursday. Before fighting erupted 2 weeks ago, one in three Sudanese, more than 15 million people overall, needed humanitarian assistance. The UN is struggling to finance its aid operation in Sudan. A humanitarian appeal for 2023 this year for $1.7 billion has received only $200 million. Russia said Thursday it's denying an upcoming council visit to detain U.S. journalist Evan Gershkovich in retaliation for the American refusal to issue visas to several Russian journalists. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov complained last weekend that the United States had denied visas to Russian journalists set to travel with him to the U.N. headquarters in New York. Gershkovich, a Wall Street reporter, was arrested last month while on a reporting assignment. Russia contends he was caught red-handed spying on a Russian military installation. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. The Pentagon continues facing questions over the history of the Massachusetts Air National Guardsman held in a classified document leak probe. We get more from the AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
Federal prosecutors say Jack Teixeira kept an arsenal of guns, said on social media he wanted to kill a ton of people, and was suspended in high school when a classmate overheard him discussing weapons and racial threats. So did the Pentagon mess up by letting Teixeira enlist, let alone get a high security clearance?
I think it's important to allow this investigation to look at the totality of this case.
Brigadier General Pat Ryder says while that plays out,
the vast, vast majority of people who are awarded security clearances come to work every day and do the right thing. And this investigation will tell us what happened and where this individual did the wrong thing.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
AP correspondent Jackie Gwynn reporting that prosecutors had wanted to question former Vice President Mike Pence about conversations and possible planning that took place before the deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol back on 2021.
An inside source tells the Associated Press the former vice president did testify before the grand jury investigating efforts by former President Trump and his allies to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Mike Pence may provide prosecutors with a first-person account about certain conversations and actions in the weeks leading up to the deadly attack on the Capitol in 2021, which included calls for hanging Pence as a traitor. Pence was supposed to testify earlier this year, but Donald Trump's lawyers had objected, citing executive privilege. But a federal appeals court ruled he could. In his memoir, Pence outlines Trump's pressure campaign, urging him to reject Joe Biden's election victory. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The head of a church in eastern Kenya, Pastor Ezekiel Ambakodero, has been arrested in relation to mass killings, according to government officials. His case is separate from that of another pastor, Paul McKenzie, accused of deaths of at least 98 people. Authorities say McKenzie encouraged his followers to starve to death to meet God. Mali and its neighbor, Algeria, Thursday said they wished to revive a 2015 peace deal between Bamako and northern Malian rebels that today lies in limbo, raising fears of renewed violence. The PAC aimed at easing tensions in the region that exploded into violence in 2012 when ethnic Tuaregs mounted an insurgency against the central government. For more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 28th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan's warring parties reportedly agreed to extend a 72-hour ceasefire, but fighting continues.
Sometimes we hear a heavy fire, sometimes there is a cool down in fire, but the situation remained the same over the past week. There is no change with the ceasefire agreement.
An analyst says the Sudan conflict was predictable. Parents of Kenyan students stranded in Sudan want faster evacuations. The U.S. ambassador to Liberia reflects on his tenure.
I made a pledge to be an ambassador to all of Liberia, and I feel that having done this trip last week and concluded with the last six counties, that I maintain that pledge.
And a new roadmap to clean up and develop Nigeria's oil-rich and restive Delta region. The stories plus Samson O'Malley's posts are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Lit reports Thursday say Sudan's army and the rapid support forces have agreed to extend the 72-hour ceasefire, which ended midnight on Thursday. However, the two sides accused each other of continued attacks. Dr. Mohamed Fath Al-Rakmand is with the Sudanese American Physicians Association. From the Sudanese city of Omdurman, he tells me that the report of the ceasefire being extended is just news. But on the ground, he says, the fighting continues.
The ceasefire is not obliged, actually. We still hear a lot of air strikes. We still hear a lot of fire between the two armies. And the battle never stops. It never stops.
But at the same time, we hear that the army and the RSF, they have agreed to extend the ceasefire. What do you know?
Yes, we hear that. It is just in the media. But actually, on the ground, the situation remains the same. The army is still using heavy air force fire, and the RSF are just working with the tactics. They are covering themselves with the buildings, within the people. They are trying to control the streets. They are trying to control as many strategic locations as they can. And right now, we cannot see an obvious winner of this war. Both of them are still in a heavy battle with each other. Sometimes we hear a heavy fire, sometimes there is a cool down in fire, but the situation remained the same over the past week. It is the same. There is no change with the ceasefire agreement.
I know many people are fleeing Khartoum, but how would you describe the situation there?
If you want to talk about the healthcare system, is your question about the healthcare?
Yes, the healthcare system, but also the condition on the ground.
The condition of the ground, you know, there is a lot of fear. People are afraid about the electricity and water supply, first and foremost. They are afraid about their safety because right now many of the prisons have been emptied and many of these prisoners are now in the streets. And a lot of crimes are being committed in the streets. And there is absolutely complete absence of police right now. There is no police in Khartoum. And this is very bad because most of the, you know, the gold markets and the phone markets have been robbed completely from their content. And the situation right now is very gloomy for most people. That's why most people who they have relatives outside Khartoum, they are trying to flee Khartoum. And most of those who have some money, they are trying to flee the country.
So what about your own safety, doctor?
Actually, I am living in Omdurman. As I speak to you right now, I am hearing an airstrike, and it is loud and clear. I can hear it very well. But my duty as a doctor and these circumstances, we cannot leave the people alone. Of course, we cannot guarantee our safety at the moment, but we are trying to do our best.
Dr. Al-Rakman, thank you so much. It's very nice to talk with you. Please be safe.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Mohamed Fath Al-Rakman is with the Sudanese American Physicians Association. He was speaking with me from the Sudanese city of Omdurman. As the fighting in Sudan rages on, there are similarities between the early signs of conflict in Sudan and the road taken by other African countries in the lead up to state collapse, such as in Somalia. The former foreign minister of Somalia, Ahmed Issa Awad, believes fighting in Sudan was predictable. Awad previously worked for the United Nations on institution and peace building in South Sudan and Darfur for 10 years. He spoke from Minneapolis, Minnesota with Haroon Maruf of the U.S. Somali Language Service.
Considering the long civil wars in Sudan and the fragmentation that happened to the fabric of the society of Sudan, conflict is between the south and the north that led to separation into two states, and also the conflict in Darfur. All these have created new forces like the rabid forces that have taken independence from the state institutions and have become almost equal to the armed forces of Sudan. The fall down of the long reign of Omar al-Bashir and his regime, it was obvious that there will be a confrontation at one point between these forces that are fighting right now.
What is the cause of the current conflict?
Yeah, so the trigger is the armed forces proposed. There was actually a resolution that was passed in which the rabid forces were asked to integrate into the armed forces, and that there will not be rabid forces separate from the armed forces of Sudan. And the rabid forces objected to that. So that was the trigger. But the root causes are the conflict of Darfur, the absence of good governance in Sudan, 3 decades of military rule and, if you want to call it, a military dictatorship that prepared the ground for the conflict that we see now in Sudan.
How do you think this conflict will end? Do you think there will be political solution, or do you think one side will overpower the other?
There's always the possibility of a political solution, but right now in Sudan, from what I understand and looking at the history of the belligerents, it's a very small possibility. The more plausible possibility is that Sudanese armed forces will be able to prevail and overpower the rabid forces. There has already been the signs of that, because the rabid forces have been defeated in, for example, an area called Merewi. Important centers that they established within Khartoum have been taken over by the Sudan armed forces. So the visible possibility now is that this conflict will end in one party, the Sudanese armed forces prevailing.
Ahmed Issa Awad is Somalia's former foreign minister. He spoke from Minneapolis, Minnesota, with viewers Haroon Maruf. The Kenyan government has evacuated several of its citizens from troubled Sudan, but as a shaky ceasefire comes to an end, the parents of Kenyan students who are stranded are appealing to Nairobi to speed up the departure process. As Ahmed Hussein reports, most of the students are from Kenya's Wajir County.
Distressed parents of Kenyan university students stuck in Sudan converge in a house in Kenya's Wajir County while they wait for news of their stranded children in Sudan's capital, Khartoum. The imminent end of a 72-hour ceasefire between Sudan's warring forces has left many parents back in Kenya extremely apprehensive, including Osman Mohamed.
My son was among those who were still stranded in the university, and he confirmed to me that there are several of them who are waiting for communication from the embassy, and they are yet to receive that information.
The first group of Kenyan evacuees arrived home aboard a Kenyan Air Force plane on Monday night from Ploich Airport in South Sudan. The group of 39, including 19 Kenyan students, were evacuated following the unrest in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, which has resulted in hundreds of deaths. Abdi Hamza is an evacuated medical student at the International University of Africa in Sudan's capital, Khartoum. He spoke to a journalist in a media interview.
We started our journey before 2 days from Khartoum, and we came by bus from Khartoum to Kosti, near the border, then from Kosti to Jodah. In Jodah, were being received by the South Sudanese government.
Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Defense, Aden Duale, told journalists while receiving the evacuees at the Jomo Kenyatta International Airport in Nairobi that Kenya was committed to ensuring the safe return of all citizens stranded in Sudan.
We'll make sure that aircrafts and all logistics are available to evacuate all Kenyans. There are over 3,000 Kenyans holed up in Sudan. And so far, we have mapped out 900 Kenyans in various parts of Khartoum and Sudan as a whole.
Despite the Kenyan government efforts, devastated parents of students who are still in Sudan have expressed fear and appealed to the government to evacuate them before fighting resumes. Osman Mohammed is a parent of a university student stuck in Sudan's capital, Khartoum.
We are strongly appealing to the government to speed up the evacuation process so that at least before the extended time elapses, that at least all the students in Khartoum have been ferried to safety places.
Kenya's Foreign Affairs Ministry had earlier this week told all stranded Kenyans to register with its embassy in Khartoum in a bid to expedite a quick evacuation process. But since Monday, there have been no further flights of Kenyans out of Sudan. Ahmed Madei is an education researcher in Nairobi.
The fact that we can't account for 2,000 plus of our students is a concern, because we're talking about 3,000, only 900 have been accounted for. That leaves you with a large number. B, the fact that of the 900 you have mapped, you are only able to evacuate 35, shows you how small efforts we are placing in. I think the Kenyan government can do better.
Sudan's armed forces and the rival paramilitary rapid support forces on Monday agreed to a 72-hour ceasefire, triggering a rush of evacuations of hundreds of foreign nationals by Western, Arab and African countries. As the ceasefire deal comes to its scheduled end, many Kenyan parents like Osman Mohammed fear for their loved ones but hold out hope of a safe return home. Ahmed Hussein for VOA's Wajia, Kenya.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, April 28th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. The U.S. Ambassador to Liberia, Michael McCarthy, says his recent tour of the remaining six of Liberia's 15 counties fulfilled his pledge to be the ambassador to all of Liberia. But he says he was startled and troubled to see multiple hospitals with no support from the government, despite aid from Washington. Ambassador McCarthy wrote that if the U.S. Congress were to ask him how the Liberian government was treating its citizens in the outer counties, he would say they are being neglected. The Liberian government has acknowledged the ambassador's concern, but said his narrative is not accurate. Ambassador McCarthy, who will soon be concluding his mission to Liberia, spoke with VOA reporter Rita Jalabweduo about his reflections.
First of all, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Togo, and I must say that it's wonderful to be back in West Africa because of the very, very special, warm reception that West Africans give everybody who comes to visit. Secondly, it was a bit of a surprise for me because I had never been to Liberia before. But that unique relationship between the United States and Liberia, which goes way, way, way back, over 200 years when the first free blacks came to the shores of Liberia and started building a country with the indigenous people. And that unique relationship still colors how we work together today.
What do you consider your most achievement in Liberia? Were you able to fulfill your pledge of fighting corruption that you made to Congress during your confirmation?
I made a pledge to be an ambassador to all of Liberia. And I feel that having done this trip last week and concluded with the last six counties, that I maintained that pledge. And I believe that the relationship that I have with my Liberian counterparts has allowed me to talk about the importance of fighting corruption in a very mature relationship.
Many in government see your involvement with local issues as being insightful. They think you are inciting the people against the government. What do you think about that?
Well, Rita, I don't really agree with that. I think even looking at the government's response to my press release would show that we all see this in terms of honest partners talking to each other about how can things be even better than they are today. And when you look at the U.S.-Liberia relationship, we are Liberia's greatest donor. We've been here since USAID began in 1961. We have been here in Liberia. So we have a long-term relationship, and we have a close relationship. And I think that gives us responsibility to be extra honest with each other.
Talking about your statement released on April 24, you mentioned, among many things, that if Congress should ask you how the elite in Monrovia are treating destitute citizens in the leeward counties, your honest answer will be those citizens are treated with a neglect that borders on contempt. What does this statement really mean?
Well, I think, first of all, the statement speaks for itself. But secondly, I think, especially for outsiders, people who have never been to Liberia, it is hard to fully comprehend exactly how cut off many of these counties are in the rainy season. Because where the roads are not paved and where dirt roads are not maintained in any way, when it starts raining, literally cars cannot get through. Many trucks get stuck. What should be an 8-hour ride can become a 2-week journey. That's how isolated these counties can become.
Finally, Mr. Ambassador, what do you want Liberians to remember you by?
I hope that they remember me as another U.S. ambassador for whom Liberia got under my skin. And I care a lot about Liberia, and I respect the partnership and the journey that the United States and Liberia have gone through. And I care so much that I have shared my concerns with Liberian citizens and Liberian decision makers.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. It was an honor speaking with you.
Thank you, Rita. You take care now.
The U.S. Ambassador to Liberia, Michael McCarthy, was speaking with reporter Rita Gilabueduo in Monrovia. A coalition of pro-environmental groups has rolled out a new roadmap to clean up and develop the oil-rich but restive Niger Delta region in Nigeria. This as tension builds among communities which accuse the government and oil companies of decades of neglect and large-scale pollution and oil spills. Nimo Bassi is director of the group Health of Mother Earth, working to push for change in the region. He says not much has improved despite communal agitation.
On some level, I'm very disappointed by the situation of things, but on other levels, I'm a bit encouraged by what I see. And the encouragement comes from the fact that more and more community persons, youths, women, individuals, farmers, fishers, are taking up by themselves to monitor the environment and report on things that are happening in the environment. People are not just keeping aloof. They're not ignoring what's going around them. They're seeking redress, and they're doing so boldly and openly. In December 2021, there was a massive well blowout on Santa Barbara River. It was a young person who was in the creeks when this happened who used his phone to record the blowout and to share it on social media. And then others jumped in to campaign, and there was a response to that. So we see young people, old people, community people acting as environmental monitors.
Can you tell us the current state? Can you tell us what is going on in the environment in the Niger Delta, and what are the new options that groups like yours brings to the table in order to change things that you think was not done before?
The situation of the Niger Delta environment is still very much worrisome. There's massive ecological degradation, rivers, creeks, even the air itself, and the health impacts have been massive. Birth defects and all kinds of things, cancers, bronchitis, breathing diseases, and so on and so forth. Much of what we are doing has been going on continuously for decades now. But from last year, we convened what we call the Niger Delta Alternatives Convergence, Now, the demands have been documented in what we call the Niger Delta Socio-Ecological Manifesto. And that manifesto demands, number one, that there should be an audit of the environment of the entire region, which means audit in terms of the environmental degradation, in terms of health, in terms of socioeconomic losses and changes, and then this will be followed up by remediation and environmental restoration as well as reparation. That has not been done before.
So what are you doing about reports that communities are not happy, apprehension is building, tension is rising, and some fear that there might be a throwback to the days of agitations and even conflict?
Well, you know, it's a big surprise that things are not blown up by now. And we are doing all we can to douse tensions and to sow seeds of hope in the hearts of the people. There are many things that have added to tension in the region, including even the new Petroleum Industry Act, which has criminalized communities. So what we are doing in a series of community dialogues and assemblies is to review what is going on, review what has gone wrong, and draw up roadmaps of what must be done. And so communities are looking at their relationship to governing authorities, they're looking at relationship to the planet, to Mother Earth, they're looking at how they relate to one another. It's a whole healing process. We term it healing territories. So we're looking at how to heal traumatized communities and how to heal the individuals in these communities.
That's Nimo Bassi, director of the group Health of Mother Earth, speaking with viewers Chinedu Ofowo from Benin City, Edo State. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the Confederation of African Football. The continent's football governing body on Thursday acknowledged that Kenya, Tanzania and Uganda have launched a joint bid for the 2027 Africa Cup of Nations, which could bring the continental showpiece to East Africa for the first time. CAF also confirmed bids from Algeria, Botswana and Egypt. The Kenyan government in December approved a cabinet proposal to back a bid for the biennial tournament alongside two of its neighbors. The government said a successful bid could help the national football team Harambee Stars achieve their target of qualifying for the World Cup for the first time in 2030. Kenyan Sports Minister Ababu Nawamba said he had held discussions with his Ugandan and Tanzanian counterparts, urging the plan to get a joint bidding and organizing committee for the event.
We were supposed to host the 1996 AFCON that went to South Africa and was won by South Africa. We were supposed to host the 2018 CHAN that was taken away from Kenya. So we have won bids before, but because of not being focused, not being organized, we have lost those opportunities. We want to go for it this time, but we will be better prepared. And one way of doing that is to put our facilities in pristine condition, and we have already started.
Staying with football news, Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa coach Ronani Mokoena says not winning the Champions League will not define them as failures. The Brazilians take on Algerian side CR Belouizdad in the Champions League quarterfinals in South Africa on Saturday, with one foot in the semifinal as they enjoy a commanding 4-1 win from the first leg. Ahead of the match, Mokoena warned his players to guard against complacency, but said he was proud of the growth shown by the group. Away from football news now, Senegal has been named as the top contender to host Mixed Martial Art UFC's first event in Africa. The organization has long signaled its intent to hold a fight card on the continent, particularly when the UFC held a trifecta of African champions in Francis Ngannou of Cameroon, Israel Adesanya and Kamaru Usman, both of Nigerian descent. But despite just having a sole African-born champion currently, the appetite remains to forge new ground in the UFC's only major unexplored market. In athletics, the World Athletics Continental Tour Gold Series goes to Southern Africa for the first time this weekend, with the Botswana Golden Grand Prix in Gaborone on Saturday. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson
Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, April 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday.